Chairman, so we can have a productive morning, why, I would like to move House Bill 15 out.
Okay. As is?
Unless someone on the committee...
Well, I have a, well...
Yeah.
Section 2's in firm.
Yeah, sponsor said he didn't have a process.
As the sponsor wished to have it amended.
Delete Section 2 and move it out?
I'd like to talk about a possible CS on it, perhaps a great compromise of some sort. I think what we're dealing with is two different perhaps notice standards, one for the issuance and transfer of a license, which means that somebody new is taking over a business in the community or starting a business in the community. I think, you know, there probably should be higher standards, higher notice requirements for that type of a situation. What these bills are intended to deal with are the annual renewal standards, which I can see where there needs to be a lesser degree of notice, because people know that somebody's doing business in the community and perhaps don't need, you know, the huge glaring, not huge, but the display ads and that type of thing. I'd like to leave it to the discretion of the commission, although I know you have a problem, in terms of setting regulations for notice on the issuance or transfer of a license, which to me is different than a renewal, considerably different than a renewal. And, well, just let me throw out this for proposed language. We'd have a 200 Section A, which would deal with issuances and transfers, and it would start, the board shall provide by regulation for adequate notice to inform the public and the local governing body of a proposed issuance of a new license or transfer of an existing license. The board may require the applicant to cause, and then it would take the remainder of line 23 through 29 on 240. Cause announcements to be made to inform the public of the proposed issuance, delete renewal, or transfer of licenses in newspapers or in radio or television stations beginning not later than 10 days after the application is filed. We'd also add some additional language requiring posting for rural areas, and then announcements must be bilingual when necessary. And then a second section, which would basically be House Bill 180, deleting issuance of a new license and or transfer on line 12, which would set these standards, the standards in 180, as standards for renewal. But in the previous Section A, set a much higher standard for issuance or transfer. I'm not sure if that...
Mr. Chairman.
Correct?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to see that CS done up. The only part of it that bothers me is the discretionary authority of the board. Maybe there's a slightly tighter way that it could be drafted to meet my concerns.
I personally feel that maybe a display ad or a small display ad is the type of notice that should be given when somebody's being issued a new, you know, there's a new liquor license coming into the community or it's changing hands. So maybe I personally feel anyway the board should have some discretion in requiring a higher standard in those cases.
Could you get us a work draft copy of your suggested CS, maybe before the next meeting we would consider it, and maybe a couple of us, if we want to mark up some amendments, we could.
Okay, that might... Do you have any objection to
it? No, not whatsoever.
Because I think it is two different problems, isn't it? Now maybe we ought to look at it as that. So
light on discretion, though.
Have you on discretion?
My amendment discretion.
Okay, so what I'll do then is get it worked up, and we'll just bring it up again at whenever we have time at the end of one of the next meetings.
But if we
meetings.
Can see the work draft copy
yeah.
before,
yeah.
I have
I'll get
the
them
boxes.
Put in your boxes. Yeah. And
and you use Red's number?
Yeah, that was, I think what we'll, sort of the committee policy will be after several bills in on the same general topic, we'll take the first bill in and use that as the CS or working document.
I thought, well, why don't you modify that, make the first bill sponsored by Democrat?
Well, that's, of course, that's
sure.
understood.
He looks when we passed the CSL.
Yeah, what happened was Terry
put out a Xerox
gonna,
flyer
he's asked
for
us to hold it
on
the committee and get together with Attorney Mueller.
You're on. this is a pretty informal type hearing on insurance, and I think a lot of members of the legislature have expressed to me their concern about the problems with insurance availability, and that perhaps the first step we ought to take was to call you in and maybe have you sort of review what you think some of the possible problems might be, and sort of just outline for the committee why insurance is tough to get for some people and in some areas.
Well, thank you, Representative McKenna. I'm pleased to give this information to the legislature, but I must warn you ahead of time, I'm not sure that what I have to say will be very conclusive or definitive, but hopefully it will give us some areas for further exploration and some general concepts to keep in mind as you study the matter. My office has received numerous letters from consumers. I think we can identify them coming from principal areas of the state, certain areas of the state, and I know that legislators are receiving them as well because those oftentimes get buffed or copied to me. And they seem to indicate that there is difficulty for some people in obtaining certain lines of insurance. We have engaged in the Division of Insurance in two principal studies. One, about the middle of 1976, we made an analysis of the rate levels and market penetrations of the auto insurance carriers in this state. Now, much of the information we gathered in the early part of the summer or late spring of 1976, and which we've been sort of using over the last 8 or 10 months, now really has to be regarded as very much less conclusive than it was then because the numbers have changed considerably. And I'll explain the factors for that. But nonetheless, it's indicative of the degree that insurance is being sold in this state and what happens with the prices of insurance in auto. The second study we undertook was principally as a result of numbers of letters that we received from the Fairbanks area, principally the Fairbanks area, but not exclusively, on the matter of the availability of fire and homeowners insurance. That study was done a little differently. That one was in the form of investigative hearings that were held in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and in Sitka. And as a result of those hearings, we gathered a fair amount of information concerning the availability of those coverages, the prices that are paid for them, and a number of the problems that people are having in maintaining insurance on their homes. Now that study is not really complete because in order to do justice to that type of investigation, we need further information, which we did not receive at the hearings, on the rate levels and the loss levels in those lines of insurance by carrier and by industry. And we're also waiting in order to get a gauge of market penetration on information that we receive annually from every carrier on March 1st. And it's very timely that you study this at this time because those figures are just now coming in. I this morning briefly scanned a couple of the reports from a couple of the principal carriers to see what's going on. But I would say that within the next couple of weeks we'll be able to give you some fairly conclusive figures that would be helpful in your study. Now, what is it that we have learned from these studies? I guess before I get into that, perhaps I ought to ask the scope of your inquiry. I'm sort of assuming, that maybe it's not correct to assume, that your inquiry centers on personal lines insurance. insurance for the consumer, the homeowners and the auto insurance. And we're not talking about the availability of insurance for municipalities or insurance for the aviation industry or bonding or a lot of other things, which are also areas of great concern. But I'm assuming your primary concern is the fire and the homeowners insurance.
Right, and we're not really concerned with malpractice either. I think if that's going to be handled by, you know, an entirely separate
Now, with that in mind, what is it that we've learned from these two studies and from our ongoing surveillance of the industry? With respect to automobile insurance, I can say categorically that there is technically no problem of insurance availability. And the reason there is not is because every person in the state who drives an automobile has access to automobile insurance. First of all, he has access through what we call the voluntary markets. And it is clear that there are a number of insurance companies which sell automobile insurance in this state and sell it in vast quantities. So everybody has access, or most everybody has access to insurance in the voluntary market. If for some reason, because of their own underwriting characteristics, no insurance company will sell insurance to them, that is to say they are looked upon as a bad risk, then they still have available to them automobile insurance through the Alaska Insurance, or the Automobile Insurance Plan, formerly known as the Assigned Risk Plan. And under the Assigned Risk Plan, a person is assigned to one of the carriers already doing business in this state and issued that carrier's insurance policy at rates which are set for all persons who go to the assigned risk pool and approved by the Division of Insurance. So I guess a categorical answer to the question, is automobile insurance available to everyone in the state? The answer is yes. With respect to fire and homeowners insurance, again, perhaps it would be instructive if I briefly explain the difference between fire and homeowners insurance. There are two ways in which to sell an insurance policy, a property insurance policy. One is to specifically enumerate the coverage provided. We will insure you against the following named perils: fire, hail, windstorm, and whatever else you want to insure, and whatever it is you want to insure, you name and list, and if you want to cover additional things, you add endorsements. And the basic fire insurance policy is that type of coverage. It covers basic catastrophes that are listed in the policy. The other way to sell property insurance is to insure against loss of the property for all perils. And then if you want to limit that in some way, to write in exceptions by endorsement. We'll cover for loss of the property for any reason except, and oftentimes there are exceptions for flood, for nuclear, holocaust, various other things. The homeowner's policy is essentially an all-risk coverage. That is the basic difference between a homeowner's and a fire policy, but there are other differences as well, and that is a homeowner's policy includes, by the way it's grown up, it includes a variety of other kinds of coverage other than property. For example, it covers the contents of the house. Fire insurance generally does not, but unless you buy it specifically. It covers liability, that is, the owner's liability to people who come on the property, slip and fall, or whatever. And then homeowners are aggrandized in a variety of ways as each company attempts to market additional things. Some medical coverage for the occupants, a loss of personal property off the premises, liability in areas other than the house itself, a variety of other things get included in the homeowners, and it's an expanded, kind of an all-encompassing product. I suppose, in analogizing to transportation, the fire policy is a basic custom Ford with no radio, no heater, or I mean, it has a heater perhaps, but no radio, AM, FM, or stereo, and the homeowner's policy starts with assuming you want everything on the car, and you can opt out certain things if you don't want. Now, the reason I explain that is that when people purchase a home on credit, that is to say, they have a mortgage on their home, the mortgagee requires, obviously, that the property be insured. to protect, obviously, his collateral. That requirement is fulfilled if the person provides him with a fire policy or a policy providing fire and extended coverage. The homeowner's policy extends additional benefits to the homeowner with which a mortgagee is generally not concerned. Now, the reason I give this brief explanation is because when I talk about availability, the availability is different for the homeowners than it is the fire. And homeowners is available in this state. It is marketed. The marketing of homeowners has increased, and there are perhaps a stable number of companies selling it, but each of the companies selling it are selling more of it than they have in the past. But it is not available to everybody in the state. The underwriting requirements for a homeowner's policy are necessarily more rigid than for a fire policy because the coverage is much broader and they look for things that they really are less concerned about in the fire policy. I received a telephone call about 3 days ago from a man in the Delta Junction area who told me that his homeowner's policy was non-renewed. The company would not renew his homeowner's policy. And he was very upset because it created hardships, and it happens to be one of these veteran loan situations, and they were about to foreclose, and you know the story. So I began to do some inquiry, and I called the company that had issued the homeowner's policy previously, and indeed, the company has changed its underwriting requirements. They are requiring a completed home, one that is stable, the walls are painted and wallpapered, and the guy is in and living there. And that's important because they want to know the house is occupied and being protected by the owner. And because this particular home was in the course of construction, this fellow was taking a long period of time to build it himself, which is not atypical in this state, but it was not fully complete. It hadn't been fully painted, and there were some things that hadn't been done inside. The company's underwriting restrictions were tightened up, and he did not qualify. So I inquired of the company what that meant in terms of protecting his mortgage, and I learned that there was no reason why they could not provide him with a fire and extended coverage policy. So there is a restriction on the availability of homeowners insurance, but there is much wider availability of fire insurance that provides coverage sufficient to protect mortgages. Now, in the course of the hearings, particularly in Fairbanks, I think I could say that we determined the availability of fire insurance, and now I will use the term fire insurance to include homeowners coverage, which I guess could be characterized by the testimony of one of the witnesses, an agent doing business in Fairbanks, who said, as long as the house is not burning at the time, I will insure every person who comes in my door. Now, I guess that is the keynote for talking about the next step in your study. I've said everybody can get it. The real question and the real nut is how much must he pay for it? Now, that is a much more difficult thing to answer, but I will make an effort. Insurance rates tend to stratify. That is to say, because of the forces of competition, when you have numbers of carriers providing coverage in an area, carriers tend to carve out the market areas that interest them. And it's interesting to note that one man's crumb is another man's banquet. Let me explain it in this way. We have carriers that provide both automobile insurance and fire insurance at extremely competitive, by that I mean very reasonable low rates. But these carriers do so for a variety of reasons. One, they are able to provide it at somewhat lower rates than other carriers because of the way they market their insurance. They do not use the independent agency system. They use what's called direct writing, like State Farm and Allstate. Allstate, you go into the Sears store or to a Sears agent. State Farm has their own people in little State Farm offices all around the city. That's one of the reasons they offer it at a less expensive rate. Another is they're very selective in their underwriting. They are defining for themselves a pool of insureds that have very good risk characteristics, and as a result, the people in that pool tend to pay a lower overall rate, and yet the company tends to make a profit. Now, there are other carriers in the state who, at the other end of the spectrum, take what State Farm would regard as a bad risk, and they write it, and they write it at a profit. And the reason they can do so is because they charge a very much higher rate, but they attract the majority of those that are the rejections of other carriers. So they are also defining a pool of people that are substantially more hazardous and who are willing to pay a much higher rate. But the law of large numbers works in various ways. Not only does it work across the whole spectrum of the body of insureds, but it works within little pockets in them. If, on the average, only a certain number of people are going to be subjected to loss, that would be true even among a body of high-risk insureds. That is to say, if I only had high-risk insureds, only some of them are going to have losses, and a lot of them won't. And if I get enough rate, I can make money riding high risk. And that's the way a number of carriers write in this state, both auto and fire. And in the middle, between the very low premium direct rider writing the premium risks and what we call the substandard riders, those that write in the state but do it by writing at very high rates, there is a fairly broad spectrum of carriers in the middle that are providing standard coverage through the independent agency system at a fairly good spread of rates depending upon how that carrier does business. And again, this is in both the auto and the fire insurance. So the rates tend to spread out, and it's hard to make a characterization of whether the rates in the state are high or low on an overall basis, because I think you have to look at these several components. And I would say that they need to be studied in three parts. One, the preferred risks. Two, the standard risks. And three, the substandard risks. Now, there is a fourth market in this state, or I should say a fourth segment of the market in this state. All that I have been speaking of refers to the admitted market. And by that I mean those carriers who are admitted, or in other words, have a certificate of authority from the Alaska State Division of Insurance to do business in this state. These are companies that subject themselves to our jurisdiction. We approve or disapprove their rates. We regulate their activities very carefully. However, it is possible for a person to go outside of the state of Alaska to buy their coverage. A very simple illustration would be if any one of you gentlemen were entering into business and you decided to go to your uncle in New York and ask him to indemnify you against loss for a certain thing. In a very pure sense, that's a form of insurance, but we don't regulate it because it's a private deal that was consummated outside the state of Alaska. There are companies, you may find that you can't buy insurance at an acceptable rate in this state at all, and you may go outside and negotiate your indemnity from a carrier that specializes in providing insurances of a unique nature. This is called the surplus lines market, or the excess insurance market, or the non-admitted market. It goes by a variety of names. And we do not regulate this activity, or at least we don't regulate it anywhere near the way we do the other. We do not know or regulate their rates or policy forms, and we have very little jurisdiction over their affairs, and certainly not their solvency. I guess historically, the surplus lines market built up where specialized risks could not obtain insurance from admitted market carriers because the admitted market carriers had filed rates and were approved, and the only way anyone could write it would be at a much higher rate of insurance, and since that higher rate wasn't approved by the division, they went outside the state to get around the state law and bought it in the surplus lines market. Now, having told you that we don't regulate the carriers, I should point out that we do regulate the purchase of that insurance in this way. As a basic law, no agent or broker may negotiate insurance in this state except with an admitted carrier. The exception to that is that there is a business that has built up of persons who specialize in procuring surplus lines insurance. They are called surplus lines brokers. And we do not regulate the surplus line carriers, but we do regulate the surplus line brokers. We do not regulate them as to the rates they charge and so forth, but we do collect what amounts to an in-lieu tax. We don't collect a tax from the carrier, but we collect an equivalent tax from the surplus line broker. The broker has higher levels of responsibility in assuring the financial quality of the companies he places business with, and in other ways we regulate them. Now, the reason I mention that is that in both auto insurance and in fire insurance, there is access to and use made of the surplus lines market. And this is the fourth element in this spectrum. And necessarily, because of the way it writes, this is perhaps higher, or at least in a range with, the substandard market. Now, just to give you some examples of the substandard, of the surplus line markets, Lloyd's of London is a surplus line market. There are carriers, other insurance companies that do business in England, Italy, Japan, France, Belgium, Germany, and even Russia, that brokers go to outside the country, called the alien market. And surplus line brokers use American companies that are not admitted in Alaska, California Union, Market Facilities, All-Star, and there are others that are licensed, say, in California or Pennsylvania, not licensed here, but right here on a surplus lines basis. Now, for an individual home, probably little use is made of this, but in some cases, surplus line markets have to be used. And in order to understand that, at this point, I'd like to sort of divide the discussion between auto and homeowners or fire, because now we get into some things that relate only to that one line. And since fire insurance hearings were held recently, that's more fresh in my mind, and I'd like to discuss that first. What tends to put a person in the premium class, the standard class, the substandard class, or force him to go to the substandard or to the surplus line market? Well, I think essentially it should be obvious that what does that is the quality of the property. But more particularly, it is the level of fire protection available to control a hazard in that area. I guess at this point I should introduce a new concept that you need to keep in mind when you study this issue, and that is the concept of the rating bureau. Historically, insurance rates have been narrowly regulated by the departments and divisions of insurance, and it has been a requirement that all carriers file their rates. Now, in this state, we have some 700 carriers licensed in the business, about 400 property and casualty carriers. And if all 400 were to file their rates, they'd never get approved. It's just an inordinate amount of paperwork. But more importantly, from the carrier point of view, no carrier generates enough business on their own to be able to produce their own statistics. And so they join together, pool their statistics into one base so that they can all get a measure of what the loss potential in a particular state is. And they do this in the form of a rating bureau. The bureau collects these statistics, distributes them to its member carriers, and in addition to that, will file on behalf of the member carriers rates for approval of by the Division of Insurance. We approve the rate of the rating bureau. We have approved it, in effect, for all of its subscribers. Now, the reason I think it's important to keep that in mind is that much of how the insurance cost is determined is really by some of the procedures used by the rating bureau. Now, very early on, the fire rating bureaus determined that they would classify rates by fire protection class. That is to say, they would grade the community, assign it a grade, and then they would establish rate relativities among the communities based on these grade differentials. Just to give you a very quick example, they would go into a community like downtown Anchorage, and they would evaluate the fire protection. They would look at the water pressure, the size of the pipes, the frequency of the hydrants, the quality of the fire department's training, response time, amount of water carried to the location, a variety of things, the signal systems, alarm systems, and what have you. And they would put that based on how they evaluate that town in one of these grades from 1 to 10. I believe today Anchorage is, I think, a 4. Or they might go into a remote area and find it has no hydrants, it has a volunteer fire department with fewer trucks and less water carrying capacity and a variety of other problems, and it would be graded an 8 or a 9 or a 10, 10 being that class which has essentially no fire protection. Now, what happens is that the Rating Bureau, which today the Rating Bureau is the Insurance Services Office, or ISO, about every 10 years goes around and grades these communities and assigns them the grade. And almost every carrier, I guess I could say all carriers, including those that are not members or subscribers to the ISO, use the ISO's town grading system because it's there and it saves them money from having to do their own. Now, a carrier, of course, can use the town grading system in a variety of ways. Obviously, it can use it for purposes of defining its classification for rating, but it might also use it for underwriting reasons. It might say, for example, here are the rates for classes 1 through 10, but we're not going to write any 10s. That would be an internal underwriting decision. Or we'll only write 8s provided certain things are done. And this now is beginning to get into what some of the problems are, principally in the Fairbanks area. Fairbanks, I believe the downtown Fairbanks area is a 5. Fairbanks is a politically defined jurisdiction. It's got city limits. And the fire service in Fairbanks, in the city of Fairbanks, goes to the city limits. And if you're on the other side of the line, the fire department doesn't respond, and properly so. So at the city limits, there's a difference in grading. One of the things we found, which you might be interested in, is there is an area which is outside the city limits. It's called, the College Service Area. But simply because of comity or neighborliness or for what reasons we haven't yet figured out, the university has a fire department or has fire service capability. And for the last 19 years, they've been providing fire service capability to this College Service Area, which is outside the city limits of Fairbanks, but it's receiving essentially equivalent fire service. One of the significant complaints we received was, why is it that we, with very good fire service, are rated a 10 by the ISO, when our neighbors are also rated a 10 outside the College Service Area, and they have got nothing in terms of fire service? So one of the things we explored at our hearings was try to find out about that, and we learned that it's just because there is no political entity in the College Service Area which has entered into any kind of arrangement with the university to make it obligatory on the university to provide the service. They simply done it because they're there. Now, historically, I'm told that in the last 19 years, the university has never failed to respond to a fire in that service area. So while it's no contract, it's pretty good assurance that the next fire will be responded to by the university. As a result of that hearing, we required the ISO to go and regrade as if there were an agreement. And I'm advised, I'm told orally by phone, we're going to get it confirmed in writing. The ISO has already been up there, I think within the last 2 weeks. They have regraded, and it's probably going to be, one area is going to be a 7 and one area is going to be an 8. So we've accomplished already some good out of this. Now, I'd like to hasten to point out that this grading differential has an impact on rates. It has an impact on rate relativities, but it doesn't translate into an immediate change in rate. And one of the things apparently that's frustrating, I think the city of Juneau expressed some concern to me one day about this. Somebody got a hold of the book that said, these are the qualifications for a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And the assumption was made, if we do certain things, and I don't remember what they were, but beef up our fire department or beef up the signal systems or whatever, if we do these things, then we're instantly graded from a 5 to a 4 or a 6 to a 5 or whatever. And then when it doesn't happen, there's a great deal of concern and disappointment, particularly among those that have to pay the fire insurance premiums. Well, the grading system is such that it's, well, first of all, we can urge them to regrade at any time. But two things have to be kept in mind. One, the grading is pretty much a judgment thing, and there are a tremendous number of objective measurements, but it's a point system, and while you may do certain things that tend to put you in a better classification, it may not automatically do that. But more importantly to the point, I think, is that rates are a function of a variety of things. Protection class distinctions are only one of the things that define rate. Overall experience, individual company judgment about what their rate levels ought to be, and a variety of other things. And so while the community may spend a tremendous amount of money beefing up its fire service capabilities, that may not get translated into visibly lower rates. It may on the long run, because if the fire service is better, then the losses are going to be lower, and that will eventually work into the statistics. Now, one of the things that was that we learned, I found it very interesting, because I hadn't thought of it this way before, out of a variety of comments made at the hearing, was that oftentimes communities feel it's important to spend a tremendous amount of money to make a change in their fire service, hopefully to get regraded, that doesn't get translated into an equivalent saving in fire premium in the area affected. That is to say, if you spend $250,000 to put in a Gainwell fire alarm system throughout the city, or I'm sure it costs more than that, but whatever, let's say you spend $250,000 on something, you may not see over, say, a 5 or 10 year period, a $250,000 saving in fire insurance premiums among all those affected. And that's why, as it was pointed out to me, it's kind of unfortunate for a community to spend a lot of money doing that, if that's their only goal. There may be a variety of other very valid reasons to spend the money, but the expectations in terms of fire insurance savings has to be kept in mind, that there are other factors that bear on. Well, I'm straying somewhat. There are a variety of other things that impact on whether or not a fire insurance policy will be written. And again, these center around the Fairbanks area. One of the things that was a continuing complaint, both in correspondence to the division and in these hearings, was the difficulty people with log homes have in procuring fire insurance. Now, I thought I had graduated from Chechako to sourdough. Since I've been here the requisite period of time, I haven't done all three of the tests, but other than that, I've passed some other tests, I think, which are equally tough. but I slipped into a Chechako mistake of calling from log cabins, and I was quickly caught short by one of the residents who pointed out that there are indeed in Alaska some log cabins, but she lived in a log home, and there was indeed a difference. And I have to agree there's a difference, because there's some very beautiful, lovely homes, quite a number of them in the Fairbanks area, in fact Anchorage and Juneau too, where the exterior is of a log character, I guess. But the home is hardly what you call Abe Lincoln-type log cabins. Now, when the underwriting decisions are made by an insurance carrier outside the state of Alaska, that is to say, when the home office at Bloomington, Illinois says in a policy manual that goes out to all of its insurers, we will not insure log cabins. It's understandable why they would do that. I suppose if I were in Bloomington and never had been to Alaska, I would have done it. And that's what they did. And thus, a lot of log cabins are not being written by many of the carriers, even though from all other standpoints, the home meets all of the qualifications. One of the, most notable offenders in this area is State Farm in the Fairbanks area. I think the reason, however, in fairness to State Farm, that they are the most obvious offender is because they're probably providing the most fire insurance in the Fairbanks area. They're one of the largest writers up there. So they are trying to control their book a little bit. But when we announced that we were going to hold these hearings, I was pleased to learn that the regional manager from Salem, Oregon came to the hearings, as did an attorney from Bloomington, Illinois. He came out to see the problem. Instead of coming to Anchorage and testifying on the first day, they went directly to Fairbanks a day early to look over Fairbanks prior to the hearing. And when I got up to Fairbanks, I was immediately met by the gentleman from Bloomington, Illinois, who said, "My God, I didn't realize what Alaska was like." He said, "One of the State Farm agents lives in a log home." And he took me out to this area. And he said, "I never saw anything so beautiful as a swimming pool. It's a several hundred thousand dollar establishment." He said, "If that's log homes, we've goofed." That has been corrected. They've gone back and they've readjusted their underwriting. And I think one of the things that is, I think, working to the good of the community here is I've made an effort in very, shall we say, sly ways to get the industry to come up here and take a look at us. And I'm proud to do that because every time they do, they go back with a substantially more favorable impression and a more relaxed attitude about writing them here. So we like to hold lots of hearings to get the industry whipped up and get them up here because it always tends to improve markets. But there is a very real problem with log cabins that I've been advised of, and it makes sense to me. If the log cabin is a genuine log cabin, that is, it's not a half round where it's just the exterior. If it is a full round or one of these three-sided logs or something like that, where there is a log interior, rounded interiors, there is a very serious problem in case of a partial loss. Because if, for example, there's a loss in one room or a part of a thing and there's a substantial charring on the inside, the only way you can repair that, if you're going to put it back the way it was prior to the fire, is to carefully, systematically, log by log, dismantle the house, take out the charred logs, replace them, and then stack the thing back up again, which in effect is totally rebuilding the house. One of the people who testified said, well, you wouldn't have to do that if my house burned, just put up some drywall in front of it. Well, she may be very well to say that now, but I know if I had a $100,000 or $200,000 log home, I would be very disappointed if it, you know, looked like somebody else's frame house after a fire. So the insurance carriers, recognizing this particular difficulty, will continue to insure a log home. But State Farm will continue to insure log homes, but they have imposed a 25% surcharge to cover this additional expense. Now, I guess it's safe to say that Fairbanks is kind of the center of the problem of fire insurance because I'm reasonably certain that in the rest of the state there's very little problem as to either availability or price. But Fairbanks, there is a problem of price. And it gets more severe as you move out of the radius, move out from the city of Fairbanks. For example, State Farm perhaps has perhaps the most liberal underwriting policy up there, and that's why they write so much business. But they have said that they will not write beyond 15 miles from the city limits of Fairbanks. Now, in further exploring that, we found that isn't precisely what State Farm said. What they said is that they will only allow their agents to write what the agent can reasonably service. And service means not only sell the policy and issue the, and collect the premium, but in the event of loss, to go out and properly assure reconstruction and so forth. And the 15-mile radius has sort of been defined as what that is. But a State Farm agent, if he's willing to undergo the service expense, is not prohibited from writing beyond those limits. And in fact, there are some State Farm agents who are writing considerable distances outside of that. One, for example, I know travels once a week up to Delta Junction and services accounts up there, and I think goes to other places too. But as you move away, you are removing yourself, obviously, from any kind of rational fire protection. Any loss is undoubtedly, from an insurance standpoint, going to be a total loss. And more than that, the replacement potential is going to be extremely high. The replacement cost is going to be extremely high. Because not only do you have the normal high cost of building in Fairbanks, but now you've got to transport everything to the 32-mile line in order to get it built. So there's a tremendous reluctance to even insure, and if they do at all, to do so at surcharge rates, and then only provide the fire insurance, not the homeowner's coverage. Now, I'm sure you have more questions about fire insurance, but I don't know really what I... Yes?
Sir, one question before you leave fire insurance. I followed you fine on the regional rating, so to speak, Mr. Block, your 1-to-10 ratio. How do you intercede in there, what you gave us earlier, the four risk categories? Is it superimposed upon that? In other words, here I'm in region 5, let's say, by your ISO. Then do you further, would insurance companies further subdivide me into your preferred risk, standard risk, substandard risk, and that type of a deal as far as writing my insurance?
The town grading system, or the fire protection class grading system, is a matrix for the distribution of rates.
All right.
But each carrier, well, first of all, the ISO files an ISO rate that fits in that matrix with us, and we approve it.
Okay.
And then all the subscribers to the ISO use that rate. So if a large number of carriers will all be using the same rate.
Regardless of preferred versus substandard risk. In other words, if I live in a...
I'm
sorry.
So large number of carriers will file that rate. Now, the preferred risk carriers, let's say State Farm and Allstate on one spectrum, or the substandard carriers at the other end of the spectrum, will make an independent file. But they will use the same matrix. They will simply say, we're going to use ISO rates, but a 15% off below, or 10% higher, or 30% higher, or whatever. So they'll use the same matrix, and the relativities, that is, the percentage difference between a class 4 and a class 5, will probably be the same or similar, but it'll all be jacked up 15% or reduced by 15%, depending upon how the carrier wants to underwrite. Now, that does not prohibit a carrier from filing modifications of that. They could say, for example, as in fact State Farm did, they had a rate for 9 and 10, and they went through some machinations that got everybody very excited. They created a protection class 11. It got me excited because I don't know how you can be more unprotected than fully unprotected. On investigation, what they had done was they had a rate for both 9 and 10. What they did was create an 11, so they ended up with a total of 10 rate classes, but they were numbered differently, and divided what the ISO had as a 10 into two parts. That unprotected, but within 5 miles of some fire service facility, and then outside of 5 miles of a fire service facility, and created a grading distinction for that, because otherwise they wouldn't have written the ones that were outside of 5 miles. So it provided them with an additional surcharge, in effect what happened. So I think that...
Thank you.
Claire?
You mentioned State Farm.
They have a much more rigid, well, in fire it's kind of funny, they have a more rigid underwriting, and yet they're probably one of the most aggressive writers in the Fairbanks area, taking a lot of things other carriers won't.
That's my point. Yeah. There's no apparent contradiction here. They're preferred risk. They have, in fact, been the most liberal writer, which you also say.
Of course, you've got to bear in mind, State Farm is in a box, and God bless them for it, because otherwise we'd be in problems. You have to understand a marketing difference between the direct writing company and the companies that utilize the independent agency system. An independent agent is just that. He's an independent businessman, owns and operates his own business. He's free to negotiate an agency contract with the IMA or the CNA or Fireman's Fund or Industrial Indemnity, Travelers, or whomever. And in fact does negotiate agency agreements with 3, 4, 5, or as many as he can get contracts with, because he wants to have plenty of facilities to place his risks. The independent agent is not obligated to place a risk with, say, the INA, simply because he has an agency contract with him. If the risk comes in, and it's a good risk, INA may ask him to, but he may decide to place it with Travelers if he has an agency contract with him. Well, since the independent agent has what I would call reduced loyalty to its carrier, to carriers with whom it has an agency contract, the same is true of the companies for the agents. If a company, you know, like Industrial Indemnity and the Fireman's Fund did in the early part of 76, decide we don't want to write anymore, they'll cut their agents off, and the agents are left with no markets, as happened in very severely here in the early part of 76. They say, we just aren't going to use you as an agent anymore. Now, State Farm is in a different situation, because a State Farm agent is an agent only of State Farm. He's an independent businessman and runs his own business. But by virtue of the relationship that he has with State Farm, he cannot place business with any other entity but State Farm. And State Farm has underwriting control over what he places with them. And you can understand what would happen to State Farm's marketing plan if they said, as Industrial or Fireman's Fund might have said, we're going to cut our business 50%. And the fact that you can't get commissions from us by placing that business is tough. That's your problem. State Farm says that to an agent who can't place his business anywhere else, and you're talking about the livelihood of that State Farm agent, and they know that. So they're sort of locked in to preserve their market facilities in the state to always provide a market to that agent. And for that reason, State Farm has grown considerably in the last year because they've allowed their agents to write a lot of business in the state to keep it going. And so the agents are taking advantage of it, but they've tried to tighten up on their underwriting on an overall basis, but allow them to write the flow of business in the Fairbanks area. They are allowing them to write the log cabins, but with the surcharge. So I think that has to be borne in mind. Well, let me talk for a minute about the auto insurance, because I think the principles and concepts are the same. The results are the same. We still seem to find this stratification of rates between the preferred, the standard, the substandard, and then the surplus lines market. Obviously, however, the criteria for getting into one of these categories is different. We have in Alaska, and these are 1975, these figures are based on 1975 writings in the state. And they will change dramatically when we get our 76 figures. We've identified 30 carriers in the state who write more than $250,000, or wrote more than $250,000 of auto insurance. We've identified of those 10 that in 1975 wrote more than $1 million of auto insurance.
Are those premiums or?
Written premiums.
Okay.
Perhaps it might be more meaningful to take it in terms of cars insured, and we can get that information, but I didn't have it at the time. The automobile insurance seems to center primarily around three carriers. State Farm, Allstate, and Geico. State Farm, well, all three of those companies, they write the largest amount of premium, and they are also considered to be in this premium class of business. They wrote at very competitive rates. And then we have the business spreads out immediately from there over a fairly wide base of carriers. Now, I'd like to go back, if I may, and talk a little bit about this market again, about how the independent agent operates and the relationship between the independent agency and the company, because it's very relevant to the market of auto insurance. Taking this chart and looking at this alone, I think I could say very persuasively that there is good market distribution, there is competition. We have 30 carriers in the state writing more than $250,000, so it looks like there's plenty of resource available for auto insurance. But looking at that alone could be very misleading. The independent agents in Anchorage and Fairbanks and Juneau and to a lesser degree in Sitka and Ketchikan are large enough that they can command agency agreements from a number of different carriers. I would venture to say that most all of the agents in these various towns that I've named represent at least two and maybe three and four carriers where they can place business. And so they have a spectrum of choices depending upon the underwriting characteristics of the risk in which to place this person. But once you get out of those towns and you get into Kodiak or you get into Haines or you get into some very small communities where there are independent agents, what happened in the early part of 76 was that these carriers that had heretofore provided agency agreements to these agents cut them off. And they did so because the agent just couldn't generate enough business to make it worth their while to maintain that agency agreement. The carrier, for example, might look at the guy's book of business, and he may generate $25,000, or really, if he's a really good agent, $35,000 or $40,000 of automobile premium. Well, if there's one loss out of that very small book of business, if you just take a look at the loss ratio for that agent, you know, the guy's either a boom or a bust. And the carriers, when they underwrite by agent, if they're underwriting their book of business by underwriting the agent, they're going to cut off those agents who are not generating a sufficient amount of business to say that they're getting a profitable book of business from that agent. The result of that is that the agents in the smaller communities, in effect, ended up with no market. That is to say, they could not place business as an agent. And so they were forced to place their insureds in about the only thing they could do, and that was to go through the surplus lines market. That is to go to a surplus lines broker and place it on an individual placement basis, or to place it with the assigned risk pool. But there was a third choice, and that is some of them were able to get agency agreements with the substandard carriers who were less careful in their underwriting. Now, what that means is that if you are an insured, and let us say if you were an insured in Anchorage, you would be a premium insured. State Farm would insure you with their lowest rate. But you don't live in Anchorage, you live in one of these remote communities, and for convenience you go to this agent and you say, I want insurance, and he says, here are your choices. You can have the substandard carrier, you can have the surplus lines market, or you can have the assigned risk pool. And so a lot of good risks, for that reason, are flowing into the wrong rating grouping. Now, in my opinion, there is good competition in the auto insurance market statewide, but I'm sure I can identify jurisdictional pockets where there is no competition. And I would say the choice between the assigned risk pool, the surplus lines, and substandard is hardly what I'd call vigorous competition. Okay. So we do have a problem in that area. Now, I believe the problem is probably going to be alleviated to a large degree this year, simply because of some factors I'll get to in a moment, but a lot of the reasons the carriers were very restricted are changing. But that is one of the factors that's had an impact on the cost and distribution of automobile insurance. There has come to my attention something that I haven't finished exploring yet, but since we're talking generally, I'll share it with you. I'm beginning to receive some complaints that carriers are not writing military personnel. This is not a new underwriting requirement. Carriers have had this for a long time. But I think it's being newly imposed in Alaska. And it's a particularly burdensome situation in Alaska since we have a high percentage of our people are military personnel. And I also think that some of the reasons that justify that underwriting judgment elsewhere, military personnel are essentially transient. They're here for a while and then they leave and take their cars. A lot of things like that don't pertain to a large segment of the military here. And a person comes up and works with the Coast Guard, he's not about to get shipped out. I mean, he lives here, his duties bring him home, at least for the weekends and so forth. So a lot of the things just don't pertain. And I've asked the industry to investigate this and get back to me and tell me what they're doing and why. And I've gone to the carriers which have been accused of the most frequent use of this problem in practice to find out what's going on. I don't have an answer for it, but that is one of the problems. Now let me just finish my observations, which I'm certain not answered all your questions, but close by giving you some general observations about the industry. One of the reasons in 1976, latter part of 75 and 76, that we had the severe problems of availability that we did have, or cost, I guess is a better way to say it, that we did have, were these things that I've stated over and over and over again about the severe losses that the carriers have incurred, the depletion in surpluses because of the reduction in valuations of securities, change in management, a variety of things. The reports that I've seen, the information we're starting to receive in the insurance department, and my general gut reaction is that we've overcome all of that. I did just a quick snap look at the books that are coming in, the March 1st reports. Surpluses are up dramatically. Profits are up dramatically. Earnings are up dramatically in almost every carrier. When obviously there are going to be variations in amount, degree. Some are still losing, but losing less than they did the year before. Others are going to do worse. But on the whole, I think the industry has rebounded to unprecedented level of health and prosperity. That's not bad, that's good, but nonetheless, it is good because I think what it means is that we're going to start the backside of this cycle, and that is they're going to start vigorous competition again. I'm hopeful that they don't so vigorously compete that they price themselves into the dilemma they were in a couple of years ago, but hopefully they will compete to the extent that we will find genuine competition in all geographic areas of the state for all personal lines. Certainly a leveling of rate, if not the lowering of rate. and better availability and choice for the consumers. There's one last comment I'd like to make, but I will not develop this point. And it relates primarily to auto and general liability. It does not relate to the fire or the homeowners too much. And that is, I think that the legislature needs to be constantly wary of those fundamental things that make insurance difficult to write. And I've spoken of them in terms of malpractice, but I've not spoken of them very much in connection with other kinds of liability coverage. But they equally pertain. If our courts and if our legislature is going to persist in expanding the concepts of liability to the point where an insurance carrier cannot properly evaluate or anticipate the level of exposure they're subjected to, then they have only one choice, and that's to cease writing in that area. I heard the other day of a couple of things which I think are just tragic, because I think they're going to have an adverse impact on the writing of insurance. We have, as you know, Rule 82, which is a rule of the Supreme Court. It is not a rule of the legislature. That says that the court may fix the amount of fees to which an attorney is entitled, the prevailing attorney is entitled. And if the court fixes that amount, and there is sort of a scheduled guideline by which those amounts are fixed, then the attorney's fees are paid by the losing party over and above the amount of the jury's judgment, or over and out of the jury's award. The judgment would include both. Now, I've always thought that was kind of an unusually harsh rule, but I really didn't think too much about it until I heard of a situation the other day, and I cannot tell you that it is gospel, but I heard it from a reliable source, and I intend to check it out. You are familiar, are you not, with the case of the dentist in Anchorage, I think I mentioned this earlier, who was successful in obtaining a $6.5 million judgment against Volkswagen because of a seatbelt failure. Well, the little known story behind the story is that the action was also against the driver of the other vehicle. I'm told, and I don't know the facts, that it was a truck and he was drunk and alongside of the road and a variety of other things. He was just clearly and unmitigatedly liable. The insurance carrier went to, I guess, the lawyer for the dentist and said, our driver was at fault. Here's your $25,000 policy limits. Thank you and goodbye. Anything we can do, can we put it in the gold check because we're wrong and here it is. The attorney is supposed to have said he would accept the $25,000, but he also wanted his Rule 82 attorney's fees. Now, incidentally, the insurance policy provides a supplemental benefit, which is attorney's fees that are awarded. The lawyer said he wouldn't accept it unless it came with Rule 82 attorney's fees. The insurance carrier said, you haven't litigated it, we're coming and admitting it, you haven't done anything, nor should you have to. And he said, well, I want them anyway. So the carrier apparently offered Rule 82 attorney's fees based on the $25,000 award, which the lawyer refused and said, I think I'm entitled to about $1 million judgment. I want my Rule 82 attorney's fees based on that. At which time the insurance carrier is said to have thrown up his hands. Now I've been given to understand that we have a $6.5 million judgment, and the court has awarded attorney's fees, Rule 82 attorney's fees, against that insurance carrier that only had a $25,000 basic limit policy anyway, on attorney's fees based on the $6.5 million judgment. I was recently advised, and I haven't read it, of a Supreme Court opinion in which an insurance company was advised that if it is successful in a case, but it utilizes its own lawyers, house counsel, in bringing that case, that the insurance company is not entitled to its Rule 82 attorney's fees. Now, I'm sure that the wisdom of the Supreme Court would count this as justice, but it is going to create some kind of confusion among the insurance industry, and they're going to do something about it. I'm speaking on hearsay, and I don't want anybody acting, because I think all of this deserves further checking. But if there's truth to this, I can reasonably expect the insurance company to come rushing in with filings, eliminating coverage for attorney's fees, or maybe raising their rates or doing other things to protect themselves. This is only one of several areas where I think the legislature needs to take a hard look to see if our jurisprudential system is serving a purpose or whether it's gone beyond its intended purpose in creating exposures which cannot be properly identified against. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Mr. Block?
I got all kinds of questions, Mr. Chairman, but they're all personal. I'll catch them some other time.
I'm just curious about one thing. On that, who were parties to the suit in the $6.5 million?
Well, I really think it's inappropriate for me to give you a lot of information until I check it out, but I assume Volkswagen was,
and
the driver of the other automobile was. If there were others, I'm not certain. I'm
possibly
sure
the bar.
The what?
Possibly the cocktail lounge.
Cocktail lounge.
Where the guy got drunk and was driving on the other side of the street.
That may be a factor. That may be right.
I mean, that's developing law also,
yes,
right, in the state of California.
Yeah.
Everybody's going nuts, right? I mean, they're just broadening out liability for the guy who provides the drink.
That is a development. I didn't know that was true in this case. But you're
right. Oh, no, I don't. I doubt that it is in this case.
Okay, thank you. So that gives us somewhat of a background. And I think...
I have one question. Okay. This 25% surcharge on log houses, is that all over the state or just there?
I can't answer that. I think it's all over the state. That would be my assumption.
Yeah, look at my policy. I live in a log cabin.
Okay, I think in terms of these insurance hearings, what the next step would probably be to talk to some of the companies. And I'm not sure when. I try to work in an additional hearing next week sometime and maybe contact a few companies and get them in and talk to them about what the problem is from their perspective. We have the CS back on House Bill 17, which is the security deposit bill. And just pass it around and take a look at it.
Do you want to move now? Is that?
I think we might as well get it out of the way.
Is your staff going to set up a file for us on these hearings?
Yeah. Change it to approve instead of take.
Yeah.
And we did you all get copies of the proposed CS on liquor licenses bill?
There may be one of mine. I don't.
Okay.
There was one there.
Okay, we'll probably take it up again either tomorrow or Monday. We have some time at the end of either of the meetings.
Okay.
You're free to go.
Yeah.
Yes.